Good to see you guys.
Do you have a deja vu?
Which one of you is going to tell the listeners?
Go on, Aaron.
So Don fucked up. We're sitting on the deck of his place. We had recorded this podcast once already today. An hour and a half episode of, I will say, some of my best jokes and most intelligent comments I've ever made. The audio was not recorded. So here we are again recording.
I'm using a system that I don't often use and I forgot to plug it into the computer. So... And Aaron, previously when you had a joke, it was very much. And the reason why we're together, sitting on the deck, is we had our event hosted with Mick and Stephanie Dempsey at their place in Tullabudra.
Yeah, what a cracker of a night. Jack even flew up for it, all the way back from Adelaide.
And now he's wishing that he... Yeah, that's true. Now he's wishing that he didn't, given what he's going to do now.
Oh, but that was a great night. We didn't end up at the Mermaid Beach Shack. We ended up in Tally Valley, which we won't bother boring listeners how that happened, but stunning property out on the farm. Good room of, what was it, about 50?
Yeah.
50 investors and some founders in the mix. And Mick sharing some insights into how he looks at investing and how he manages his family office.
And all tribe events seem to be, it was pissing with rain, but then the heavens cleared long enough to actually have a fire. So it was a proper fireside chat.
Participants at our events, I think, are coming to know that we bring the event. There's always a little bit of drama, often weather related, but still it was a cracker of a night.
What was your favourite bit, Jack?
Oh, you can't go past the property. The property is one of the nicest properties I've been to.
Yeah, and... because it was raining so much, we had to park the cars down the bottom and everybody got a trip up on a buggy up the mountains.
Definitely a memorable one.
Now, the next event that we've got coming up is our Growth Summit. It's in northern New South Wales, just outside of Moolloombah, the one that we run a couple of times a year.
Yeah, so our Growth Summit on the 24th to 26th of May, and this is targeting B2B founders and investors, and it's really about unpacking scalable sales machines and how you build that engine for growth. We've got one of our venture partners, a new venture partner, Chris Milligan, who sold his company in the UK and now lives his life as an investor between the two continents. Coming over, he'll be talking to the group for a bit. And Mark Sowerby will be there talking about overcoming fear, which he's very qualified to talk about. So it should be another cracking one.
In the first version, Jack, you expressed surprise that Chris Milligan was coming. So...
are you still surprised?
Still surprised.
Yeah, so find out more details online. I'll put the link in there. So let's just jump into some recap. We've discussed a couple of times GoCatch versus Uber. And as that trial has been playing out, the judge actually has made a suggestion to both parties. The words were well served in negotiating an outcome in their Supreme Court of Victoria lawsuit. Is that normal that a judge gets pathway looking at the evidence and says, hey, you guys should have a chat?
Look, the default view of a court is typically we'd like you to resolve this outside of the courtroom, so please go and negotiate and mediate. But in this case, it's hard to know what to read into it, but my gut feel is, hey, this is not going to go well. You should go and sort this out privately rather than in a courtroom.
The article in Capital Brief said, following evidence from both GoCatch and Uber executives, Nichols said she had heard a significant amount of evidence, and while she couldn't force the companies to negotiate and the trial would continue, an associate justice would make contact with the companies to see if they wanted to take that opportunity. So I think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, when I look at what we've heard so far, it seems to be Uber admitting that they were operating illegally, and B, the analogy of the door to a house being unlocked and then walking in and still taking stuff in the context of that spyware.
Absolutely.
We'll see how that trial plays out. Now, also this week, interesting in the context of the Australian market, as we know, our government is looking at redoing the sophisticated investor requirements, which would knock a lot of investors out. It turns out the UK had done something and brought it to market, and what we found out is they've now reversed course.
Yeah, so this just came out yesterday. So in the UK, they lifted the sophisticated investor requirement tests, the income and net asset tests, which went into legislation into effect in January 31. And here we are late April, and it's already been reversed. So in the UK, it had lifted from £100,000 a year for income to £170,000 and net assets from £250,000 to £430,000 £100,000. And the feedback was from the market, no, this is too damaging to the ecosystem. And the government actually listened and have reversed it. So my hope is that the Australian government will see this and listen to what the ecosystem here has been saying, which is very similar, and not proceed to raise the income and net asset tests for sophisticated investors in Australia.
And lads, was a bet placed?
Did we place a bet? We talked about placing one.
That's true. In the prior episode, good memory, Jack, I was going to wiggle out of that one. We have placed a bet whether we actually think the government will take reasonable and rational advice on that or not.
I think we basically concluded they're likely to proceed making stupid decisions regardless.
But like a startup, hopefully they reverse course really quick.
Yeah. Yeah, but credit to the UK government for flipping it back to the way it was.
Now, you were sent a note this week, Aaron, from a listener asking us to discuss something around how VCs invest.
Yeah, so a founder in the community that I know shot this through us as to chat about on the show. It's a LinkedIn post from Guillaume Mubesh, and basically just talking about how VCs work. And I won't recap the whole post, but basically the fact that most funds have to go back to market to raise a new fund every 18 months to 2 years means that they are required to demonstrate some sort of portfolio value lift. And so what the conclusion of the post was, many VCs might be therefore putting pressure on portfolio companies to raise higher rounds very quickly, like within that window, to show demonstrated valuation lift of the portfolio, or to spend their capital and basically try and fast track revenue, and that growth might not be healthy. And yeah, I think, look, the question from the founder for us to chat about was, is this true of VCs and is this how VCs operate and therefore there's this negative dynamic at play? Straight off the bat, yes, there are some VCs that no doubt put that pressure on their portfolio and look at that, but we definitely have a different lens and we were chatting first time around today.
This podcast is just going to be
has referenced
referring back to a podcast that nobody's ever heard.
But yeah, it's definitely not a healthy thing. And with time, that type of approach tends to get exposed, and particularly as cycles play out, and we've seen that cycle play out recently.
Yeah, something we were all in alignment was it's a game that we don't want to play, and we want to stick to the fundamentals and invest in companies that fit our mandate, and our mandate goes back to the four pillars. We look at operational excellence, structural competitive advantage, growth opportunity, and valuation.
Yeah, and I think if you've got investors that are playing that game, putting money in and then leading rounds at higher valuation so they can mark their book up, probably lasts for a while as long as that lead investor is happy to continue playing that role. But at a certain phase, your business's performance is going to be what matters. And yes, there were some companies in 2020 through to that 2022 period where, as we've seen, even in public markets, they're down 99% now. On the long term, your company's performance is going to determine whether you can raise at a higher val.
Yeah, because at some point, they don't just look at paper gains. It has to be on cash return.
Yeah, so that company then has to be sold at some point. So somebody externally has to be willing to pay a number, and people looking to buy a company don't really care too much what the previous vals were. It's what is it worth to them now?
Yeah, I think for me, this post is good for founders to read, particularly the first kind of two-thirds of how VCs operate and the dynamics, because it does play a factor in how VCs think, like depending where they are at the life cycle stage of their own fund and its deployment. And even for us with our syndication model, looking to build our captive fund, it does affect our investment decision-making. We have one of our filters we look at is what will this company look like in the next 6 to 18 months when we will go to market to raise a captive fund. So it is really important for founders to actually understand how VCs are thinking and the factors affecting their decision-making beyond your side of the table. And so the article does shed some light on that.
Yeah. And then there was another post this week by Stefan Nasser. And that post was why VCs will or won't invest. And so we provided two columns on the why VCs won't invest. Market is too small. Founders lack core skills. Weak value prop. Too early. No traction. Cap table is broken. Unit economics don't make sense. You used Delve in your deck. No defensible advantage. No moats. That's all on the why they won't invest. On the why will they invest, it's just a single line, because they like you.
you can't fault it. It rings true. But there's a lot more causality that sits under that what they like you and how they come to that decision to actually like you. And it was interesting, actually, one of the London Mission panels, I remember there was an angel talking about deals they hadn't gone into. And one of them is, I didn't even bother looking at the deck because I was about to go on holidays and I knew I wouldn't have time to complete. So maybe on the why we won't invest is, oh, we're just too busy doing other stuff. Didn't get to it. Too busy. Of the time.
But it's true that they like you is at the bottom of that funnel. Now, as we mentioned before, what do we like? We like things that fit into the four pillars. We then, each of those four pillars has somewhere between 10 and 20 different categories. So it's a not unreasonable thing to say because they like you. But the way the post was, I think, put forward, it's like it was only to do with a relationship or a human connection. But that's not, we want to believe that there's some chemistry and some ability to assist. And we would have a fun times, too strong a word, because in early stage, you'll have some moments of fun, but the rest of it is...
Yeah. One of the things we talk about, we do, although it's not one of the tick boxes in our criteria and scaffolding, but the no dickhead policy, like there is an element of, even if they ticked every other box, but we just couldn't see ourselves actually working with them for whatever reason. There is an element of that as well.
Yeah. Now, segueing to something else, there was a company that it's fair to say had garnered some noise of some people that maybe didn't like, but their investors certainly did. And that was Kiki. And Kiki, for new listeners, is a, which is, call it, as a platform. It's a marketplace for share.
Subletting.
And they're really focused on the New York market. They had a bit of a fuck up and a misstep where they put out that they were pivoting to I think it was described as the girlies club. But what was occurring is that they were behind the scenes rejigging things so they could relaunch. And we've been following them on social media. And it's fair to say they seem to be really picking up pace.
Yeah, they're finding their feet and they're finding those, doing the unscalable things to really work out what the customers want and need. And the problem they're solving at the end of the day is trust. So yeah, they're documenting it all on Instagram. So any listeners, it's a good follow.
We talk quite a bit about authentic content that's raw. When you have a look at this Instagram page, what they're really trying to do is they're really trying to talk to their target market, which at the moment they've really honed in on that young demographic that's looking to come into New York, doesn't have the resourcing to go and get their own place. And they're trying to create experiences around that. And from a non-scalable point of view, as an example, every potential user of the website has a coffee with them first to check that they're somebody that's trustworthy to go into a property. They're then matching them with people. All of these things you can't do at scale. But if they get that right and they get a core follower group that really loves what they're doing and that starts to go viral on a social basis, they're not putting a lot into sales and marketing. They're not putting a lot into paid ads.
They're putting none, actually. That's one of their values is stay scrappy, and part of that means no money to marketing.
They're trying to do it all organically. And what I've been fascinated at is that as the weeks go on, their followership gets bigger and bigger.
And the way to look at it, like they're focusing on the bottom of the funnel, and that's the happy paying customer, and they're making each match an experience to be 10 out of 10, and they're not even worrying about the top of the funnel. And when they first launched into New York, they didn't have those happy paying customers, and the experience wasn't 10 out of 10. So they corrected course, changed the strategy and niche down. And it's just so good to see these founders learning on the go.
Yeah, on that point, it's a reminder for me of what Seth Godin and Kevin Kelly say around just focus on building your 1,000 true fans who absolutely love and need what you do. And it looks, based on their Insta, it looks like that's the kind of engagement that they're getting. Completely unscalable. But again, for founders listening, check it out just even in terms of that authentic raw content, like a lot of video content, the text out of notes to screenshot, good transparency over their fuck up and how they talk about that. But I think just a lesson in short form video content that's really authentic.
One thing I've noticed compared to this morning is that the birds are certainly out in force.
Birds are out.
That's all right. It'll mostly get edited out.
1,000 fans.
We'll take whatever we can get.
Now, whilst they're building a business doing unscalable things that hopefully they'll work out how to scale at a future point, building a durable, scalable business is really hard. And Tritium, one of Queensland's success stories that actually was a lot older than I thought, started in the 2000s, that then became a multi-unicorn on the NASDAQ and garnered a lot of press. Unfortunately, multiple entities has gone into administration with a receiver appointed. And it just highlights that it often doesn't matter how much capital you raise, how long you've been around, building a durable business is really difficult.
Yeah, I've got to say, when I saw this in the show notes, because I know we talked about some of the issues they were facing previously, and I thought that this news of them going into administration was just their Australian entity, but no, it's actually the head of the whole lot. Obviously, we don't have the details of exactly the what and how, but I think a really, sad one for the Aussie ecosystem and a sad one for all the founders and all the investors, because they'd raised a significant amount of capital before heading onto the NASDAQ.
Their product is part manufacturing and it's then part rolling it out. These are complex businesses that take a lot of capital. There does seem to be an underlying business still there producing products. So it'll be interesting to see what the receivers and the administrators can get back. The reminder here is companies that survive are the ones that A, build in a healthy manner. If you just target growth for growth's sake, and we don't know all the details, so we can't be too specific, that's what's happened here, but clearly something has gone a little bit wrong. Where we look at that is somewhere along the lines, they didn't have a culture or a climate that could identify problems fast enough and or capitalize on opportunities as fast as they're coming up. And the way that loop works is it's hard to really go after all of your opportunities if you're floating a river of problems. And that's one of the biggest issues, is that what we find with really rapidly growing companies, what we see is rapid change, and lots of change creates lots of problems. And often companies aren't scaling up their culture to be able to deal with problems faster than they're coming up. And then what happens is they fall over. And so anytime I see a company disappearing, what we do know is that clearly some issues came up that they couldn't resolve. But I think it's just a really good reminder for founders, build in a healthy manner, understand that your key to success is building a culture and a climate that is really good at solving problems and capitalizing on opportunities. And every time you read one of these stories, work out what you can learn from it and make sure you don't end up in the same position.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the companies that has grown quite out of Australia is Atlassian. So the little Aussie company that's added $3.5 billion in ARR over the last 8 years. And they've done that without ever spending more than 23% of their revenue on sales and marketing.
Just a machine.
Yeah.
And whilst growing actual cash value, ACV, from 2,500 to 12,000, producing nearly $5 billion in free cash flow over the last 4 years. For the last 5 years, being able to maintain margins over 80%, like, it's just an absolute machine. Now, at the time of this post, it was trading at 12 times ARR. I think that's a really interesting thing for founders to understand, is that at the moment in the public market, if an investor can be buying something that is growing still in the manner that Atlassian is, that's obviously de-risked to a certain point, that's producing a whole lot of free cash flow, and they've got liquidity, that unless you own half this thing, you could sell your shares tomorrow and get cash, why would they be seeking to put money into your 20 times ARR, high risk, execution challenged, not validated idea?
Totally. I mean, we're seeing this with investors, right? There's a lot of great returns that they're being offered in the market. It's a reminder, first of all, of valuations and the multiples that are in the market, and not just looking at other startups' multiples and comparative that way, but what else can investors get returns on or place their capital? And in this case, like you explained, Don, we're also seeing other asset classes providing very strong returns for LPs and investors, also at reduced risk levels.
Yeah, and in terms of analyzing a company, when you just look at its numbers, like net new ARR, $300 million 1 year, $328 million another year, nearly $800 million the next year, $900 million, like clockwork, when we talk about a scalable machine, this is what we're talking about. Clearly, they're able to generate awareness at scale, new leads at scale, convert them at scale. This is where founders need to be getting to whilst maintaining margins, and that can be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Now, Atlassian came up during the week in an article by Bronwyn Clune from Capital Brief, and that was talking about the pivot to enterprise. And what Bronwyn said in the article, over the past fortnight, Capital Brief has run stories on at least three of the shining lights of Australian SaaS, Canva, Dovetail, and Leonardo AI, which all explicitly declared intentions to target enterprise customers. What were our thoughts on this one?
Yeah, look, I've heard founders recently talking about, we're pivoting from B2C to B2B, or we're pivoting from SME to enterprise. And I understand the appeal. I see the dollar value of the contract, but I think the important thing for founders to look at here is those three that are listed in the article, Canva, Dovetail, and Leonardo AI, they're at a different stage of their own growth, their own revenues, their own balance sheet, and they have a different strategy probably each on how they're shifting to enterprise as well. I think that the danger for founders is to see it as a like shiny object syndrome. You're chasing, yeah, bigger value. And there was a founder last week in AgTech that was chatting to me, and it's, we've been selling direct to farmers, but now we've been approached by this enterprise client. The contract volume they're talking is several orders of magnitude bigger, so we're going to go after that opportunity, but not actually understanding the completely different sales cycle, the completely different service levels that you actually then need to deliver and be accountable on, the different DD that those enterprise clients do. And not just the sales cycle, but also post, like implementation takes a lot longer. Contract terms can be very different. There's insurance requirements, all sorts of things. So I think for founders that may be considering this, you really have to be aware of the massive fundamental shift that you're actually taking on and whether you have the capability to do that.
And when we look at Canva, they're a 10-year-old company. They've been like targeting the same customer segment for the last 10 years. They've taken a significant amount of market share. Like when we look at TAM as a percent, they've probably maxed it and now they're ready to go up the value chain and take on the enterprise. It's a very different mindset strategy. Like they've earned the right, now they're going up. Whereas in the earlier stage, we see a scattergun approach and it's not the best way in our view. Like concentrate resources, go after one customer segment and learn the drivers of that part.
Yeah, and not only that, Canva's buying their way in,
yeah,
buying established businesses that already have their sales and marketing machines and products that are tailored to enterprise. My fear for companies like Dovetail that are trying to be across the map, selling to SMB is different to selling to large business, which is different to selling to enterprise. All that sales motion stuff's different. The support's different. All that stuff you've already discussed, I won't duplicate. But if you're just doing it for revenue, rather than I have a value proposition that can deliver to enterprise customers in terms of support and security and product features, if it's a revenue chase, in my experience, it never works.
Yeah, I recall a founder I was chatting to, they secured their first client who was an enterprise grade client, gone through all the DD of that. But the service level agreement requirements to service that one client with uptime guarantee, service response time, that the cost base of that was 3 times the contracted value of that one contract. And in his head, the way he justified it was, we'll get more enterprise clients quickly, had actually run out of cash and now was at this cliff where they couldn't actually operate because obviously the sales cycle to get those other clients to win enough contracts to justify the cost base was taking way too long. So I think it is a real watch out for founders. Just make sure you understand that the enterprise sales process and what's involved in that.
In my experience, there's a little bit of the grass is greener that happens. So companies in the self-serve, let's call it prosumer, small business end, they look at the enterprise end and say, wow, look at those order values, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Look at the, that's probably the only thing going for it, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Large. Look at those large contract values, but don't see the 18-month sales cycle, the 15 people in an organization you have to sell to and all the other bits and pieces. But then the enterprise companies, I know, then look at SMBs and go, wow, they don't have 18-month sales cycles. Look at that. That's tens of thousands of customers. Look how quick the process is. But your product and your support and all of those other aspects has to match your motion. And like a product-led growth self-serve company trying to service enterprise gets into trouble. Just like enterprise with all of its cost base and its complexity and its implementation, you try and go to the cost-sensitive self-serve end of the market, it just doesn't work. But both parties look over the fence at each other and go, oh, wow, that looks cool.
Yeah. You do look at that market segment and go, I just want my life to be easy. I don't want all this risk of having 3 big enterprise clients that make up a massive chunk of my revenue. I'd much rather have a broad customer base so I can sleep at night knowing I'm going to have pretty consistent income going forward.
Yeah. Some people are going to enterprise, but some people are going open source. It seems that Meta and Mark Zuckerberg really are pushing into the whole open source AI. And there was a post this week talking about how it's quite ironic that Meta, the for-profit behemoth, seems to be bringing open source to AI, which is what OpenAI was supposed to do, even though it seems to be more of the commercial animal.
Yeah, and this goes back to an episode we were talking about Musk complaining that OpenAI is no longer open. There's some commentary that if OpenAI had stayed open source, it wouldn't have so much competition entering the market. Yeah, I think this, it's a smart approach by Facebook. It's interesting how this will play out. I'm still waiting to see what Google does. Is Google going to make a really big AI bet that potentially cannibalizes their existing search model? Or what are they doing? Because their balance sheet is pretty healthy to be able to have a good play.
One of the things in Hamilton Helmer's Seven Powers, though, he talks about markets where the incumbent has such inertia, they don't want to make the change. And if you're Google earning the amount of dollars you are at the moment, and what is Google? It's a set of people all on incentive programs that are normally done on a quarterly basis. If you're only going to be there for a certain period of time, can you collectively get an entire group of people to kill your cash cow and to re-innovate from the ground up? That's why a lot of the companies we invest in have a business in the first place.
It's yes, so true. Absolutely.
I do feel a bit sorry for Zuck in this, because any time he puts something out, he becomes a meme.
He's very memeable.
Yeah, that gold chain that he's now rocking and the tan is new, I guess, because in all prior ones, he's looked somewhat albino, but he's, and may he be dyeing his hair there as well? Or
maybe.
At least he's got hair, says Jack.
Jack saw the memed up bearded version and thought that Zuck had actually grown a beard.
I believed it.
You believed it.
Steal your yell.
This is, yeah.
Not steal.
The old Zuck, steal your data. The new Zuck, steal your woman.
Oh, it's too good. We also touched on, we spoke about Apple. So they've acquired another AI company. So that's 32 in total for 2023.
Yeah. Yeah, 32 companies that they acquired. I didn't realize they'd done that many.
Was that in
2023? Yeah, just 2023 AI companies that Apple has acquired.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal acquisition, right? It'd be interesting to see what patterns in there, but it did remind me one of the investor missions over to the US a while back, going into PayPal and meeting with the head of M&A, and he shared that they acquire about, on average, 6 companies a month, which is a phenomenal acquisition rate for PayPal. I see it as a kind of static product. I don't see it changing, but he described it as e-commerce plugins, different payment protocols in different countries to access new markets or new card types or whatever. It's a phenomenal acquisition rate. And this is that quote for Apple, that's just AI companies.
Yeah.
Not all their acquisitions.
Apple's been hit a little bit in the media of being a bit behind, but what we're seeing with these acquisitions that it's really targeting companies that are focused on mobile. So this latest acquisition, Data K-Lab, has expertise in efficient, low-power AI algorithms for computer vision apps that can run on devices rather than rely on the cloud. So Apple seem to be skipping all of the high-energy, high-horsepower, cloud-based stuff and really seeking to own and focus the stuff that lives on your smaller devices. And that's them focusing and being really great at something. And why would you wade into somewhere that's just got billions of dollars being spent by Google, OpenAI, Meta, at that cloud level, and they seem to be going more the device level? I'd say they listen to this podcast and really believe in focus.
Sure they do.
Now, something that else that happened this week, whilst Apple you would describe as a very cool, calm, controlled place, you couldn't use chaos in the same word as Apple. However, Bitcoin has just had its latest halving, and that one truly seems to accord some chaos, especially in its fees.
Yeah, so what is it, about every 4 years there's a Bitcoin halving? And it was interesting at South Start, all the crypto fans were spruiking this one as it'll go to the moon. It turns out the Bitcoin price has actually stayed reasonably stable, much to the disappointment of my kids that hold a bit of Bitcoin. But the transaction fees have gone through the roof, and I had to dive into it a little bit just to try and understand it. But it turns out it was a new protocol that was brought in, just happened to time it with the halving event, which has caused these ridiculous fee increases.
Yeah, so the chart that is up for those at home is that the fees are normally between, I don't know, $5 and $10 and maybe $30, and they spiked to $250 and are still hovering around the $150 mark. And you know, my view on Bitcoin is I don't really understand some of the underlying tech stuff. And not only that, from a point of view of this kind of thing being adopted by governments, governments need to control the monetary system in order to control the economy and therefore control the people. I have a sneaking suspicion they're probably not going to want to give away that control. So I'm not sold in the Bitcoin maxi's view that this is the path. But there is so much money going into the legalized ETFs of Bitcoin, it's hard to view, given there's fixed supply of something, it's just hard to not see a world if this amount of fiat currency keeps going into Bitcoin ETFs,
yeah,
the price is going to come under pressure on the upside, I would have thought. But again, this is not financial advice. We couldn't even get the recording of the first version of this right. Certainly don't listen to us in the context of that.
Yeah, look, definitely don't listen to me in the context of crypto. But I struggle to see utility when transaction fees bounced up to $250. Sorry, mean transaction fees bounced up to $250 off a relatively low base, like massive increase.
The financial system sort of needs stability and surety. And if you don't know what the fee is going to be, that's going to be a bit
problematic. But it was interesting. I did read something from the Barefoot Investor in the early hours of this morning where he was talking about things that he's hearing that shortly coins will be removed from the Australian currency and shift purely to notes and eventually, you know, notes. But this was being driven by just the cost of maintaining physical currency in the markets. The commentary was that, you know, cash trucks and security guards moving cash were actually no longer profitable businesses. And so the logistics, the supply chain of shuffling cash around doesn't make sense anymore with relatively low volumes. So he was predicting it's all going to go digital. The problem with digital is that everything can be traced. ATO knows everything you're spending anyway.
It's not the ATO that I'm worried about.
Whoever your CFO is, knowing everything you're spending. So yeah, the kind of prediction that maybe there'll be these other market drivers that actually push the demand for crypto, altcoins or whatever else. And like we were talking about this morning, markets are designed to inflict pain on the maximum number of people possible.
So those were the news items that we had. The second time round, we don't seem to have a lot to say. We just need to stop there because now the computer we're recording on has just gone
blue screen.
Blue screen of death. I do have the backup recording on this device. So this has been a really successful day and I have a feeling Jack's not coming back. He's just going to stay in Adelaide. He doesn't want to risk. Okay, well, there won't be the YouTube version. Let's keep going on your machine until mine.
All right. So this chart, which Don found, is showing the difference between improving by 1% every single day and the compounding effect of that versus getting 1% worse every day and the compounding effect of that. And it basically, it shows that even small incremental change consistently compounds into massive variance over a period of time.
And one of the things for me is it's not just about external results and effort. This actually applies to thought. The compounding interest of thought, if you make a decision to go positive versus negative, okay, you can't always be positive. Not everything's going well in the right and sometimes some really shitty situations happen and you've got to deal with them and you can't gloss over them. Within that mire, choosing at least at some point to have some positive aspects, you do that each day, each week. My experience is people that follow that approach end up in a much better position than the people that just go negative all the time.
Yeah, and a book that springs to mind here is Hardwiring Happiness, which talks about, you know, the neuroscience and neuroplasticity around the way we think and how that actually creates neural pathways that make us more prone to having that same emotional response again. So the more we live in one emotion or relive one emotion actually creates a bias for us to then occupy that emotion more often in the future. So I think this absolutely plays true on an emotional level as well as, you know, compounding in results in other ways.
So another one, this is more of a joke bit. There's two bears in the woods and there's a hunter and one of the bears says, "Oh, here's some humans coming. Don't worry, I'll scare them away." The bear yells, "Do you want to try YouTube Premium?" It was funny to me and this whole...
I find it's funny. The hunters ran away.
Oh, dear. Now, in public markets, so to some charts that we normally share, public markets, we've actually had a bit of a pullback for those that track what's happening on the NASDAQ and the S&P 500. And it is the first week to have closed below the 50-day moving average since last November when there was the last little pullback. Next one, Aaron. Now, one of the ones that's really leading that has been NVIDIA. And NVIDIA has pulled back close to 20%. And that ended one of the longest streaks that had occurred in terms of the number of days the public market had spent above the 50-day moving average. Now, in terms of NVIDIA, like 20% pullback is not actually that uncommon. Since 2000, NVIDIA has pulled back 80% multiple times. 70 and 60% multiple times. These high beta companies with a lot of expectations have a tendency to pull back quite a bit. Now, whether this turns into a 40, 50, 60% pullback, I guess time will tell, but it has been at nosebleed stratospheric conditions.
I didn't realize that variability. That's actually a phenomenal chart. It looks like someone's having a heart attack.
Now, this little chart here is the percentage of publicly traded corporations experiencing net buying from officers and directors. So officers and directors will know what the future holds for their company, knows what's looking good and looking bad. And now we've got a historical low going back over a decade that only, just 11 or 12% of officers and directors have been buying on a net basis. The average is more around about 28%. In the early days of COVID, it spiked at over 60%. So they obviously saw that COVID wasn't as bad and a lot of officers and directors started buying up their stocks big. But at the moment, it has well and truly dropped. And I wonder what they're seeing that the rest of us aren't.
Yeah, 10-year low. I was really surprised by this when I saw the chart. It's an interesting signal. Again, it's not financial advice.
No. Now, one of the things we've discussed on a few charts in the past is that the volatility indexes, the VIX, NASVOL, a number of different indexes helps track what's happening. And volatility is just measuring the range of prices on a particular period. Yes, it's elevated to what it was in the last pullback of September and October of 23, but we're still not back to that 2022 level. So in order for this correction to really take flight and for us to get a proper pullback into bear market territory, we would have to see the volatility really start to spike, and we haven't started to see that. And that is our charts for the day, and that is our second podcast.
For the day.
Jack, what does it feel to be weighed down in this kind of team?
Just wait and see if this one goes through.
Yeah, reserve judgment until the episode is live.
So apart from leaving this place, what are you looking forward to?
Jack, you go first.
I'm going around to my brother's tonight for dinner, so I've got my sister coming up as well, and then back to Adelaide tomorrow morning. And then,
sure you're not going to Perth?
The boys are giving me shit because I accidentally, for some reason unbeknownst to myself, told everyone at Mix Event that Jack's now in Perth.
And did it with full confidence, like it was just rolled off the tongue.
Nothing but confident.
Yeah. But then, yeah, looking forward to playing rugby on Saturday. We've got a top of the table clash. Should be a good game.
Top of the table clash. So no longer 70 point margins.
So it should be, yeah. Hopefully it's a good game.
Oh, that'll be good.
How about you, Aaron?
Me? So taking the kids, getting them up early in the morning for an Anzac Day dawn service, and then baking some Anzac cookies. And on the weekend, we'll be going down the coast for a bit, catching up with some friends and having a bit of a chill family weekend, which is nice. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, nice. Well, as you can see there, the van is out. It's getting packed tonight because we're going to do the dawn service and then just go 20 minutes north of Gympie. Eight families on a property there from school, like 20 or so kids. It's going to be pandemonium, but I'm looking forward to it.
It's going to be awesome. You're counting yourself in those kid numbers?
21. Wow. There's 21 children.
Libby often says that she's a single mother of four. Four kids. I'm just glad she's been here today to be witness to the incompetency, because I think she thinks I target her. But now that she's more confident that I'm an equal incompetent and spreading disaster around everyone, I think that might help our relationship.
It's not personal.
Good. All right. Well, we'll see you next week in our separate dwellings in the more functional environment. And I guess we'll call it quits. We'll call time on it. I'm going to just say well done, lads. And we'll soon find out if the listeners don't like this. If we get crickets. All right.
I got nothing.
All right. We could play the music out. Do it from here. That's the end. One last thing to do in the edit. Because normally what will happen here is like, if you're a sophisticated investor. See you, lads.
See you, boys. See you, guys.